The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
What a fascinating episode our Travel with Hawkeye team have put together for today. We're going to be talking to a couple of people that whose lives are very, very different than anything you can imagine. One is Sue Aiken. She's on the National Geographic Channel's Life Below Zero, and she lives in northern Alaska. I mean, past where trees basically grow, where there's light only a few months out of the year, and where water freezes over in the spring, and or I should say in the late summer. And it's just an amazing life that she does. And it's all chronicled on Life Below Zero. And we're going to be talking to Sue long distance here today on our Travel with Hawkeye podcast. And then we'd be jumping the pond, as they say, and going to Scotland and talking to Stevie Christie. Stevie Christie is a part of a program called Wilderness Scotland. And I know when you think of Scotland, you don't think wilderness. But actually, they do some adventures on islands that are outside of the mainland of Great Britain and Scotland, and all different sorts of things that you haven't really imagined when you think about Scotland. So we're going to be talking long distance to Stevie and find out what he has to say. And I will tell you, be prepared, because you're going to fall in love with his accent. I just want you to be ready for that. That's a little bit later in the podcast. But first, let's go to the north, up to Alaska, and talk to Sue Aiken from the National Geographic show Life Below Zero. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I have to say I'm fascinated with your life and how it's portrayed on Life Below Zero on the National Geographic Channel. First of all, just kind of refresh everybody with what goes on in your life. You are the caretaker or the steward of a hunting camp. Is that correct?
You know, it's hunting is one of the aspects people come here for. I'm the owner of sort of a twisted bed and breakfast on the North Slope of Alaska. You can come if you want to visit the Arctic and you need a place to stay and some food. I'm your gal.
Okay.
But for 9 months out of the year, it's just me, and I live by myself out here.
Yeah. So for 3 months of the year, hunters come, and give the name of the camp.
It's Kavik River Camp, and it's hunters, biologists, whatever your reason to be in the Arctic is, I'm the place to stay. But for the remaining 9 months, then it's just me and me in the wilderness.
And then we watch your life on Life Below Zero on the National Geographic Channel. And how many months out of the year, they film you mainly only in the winter, right? They film you in the months that you're there alone.
They film me, you know, we do 12 episodes of the winter and then 12 episodes of what's called the thaw. People, in the original portion of the show, it was just the winter time, but people wanted to know, you know, how all of the talent on the show, well, what happens in the summer? What happens when it gets nice? So they've added in the thaw over the last two seasons, and that's popular as well, and you get to see what happens when the sun's shining in the... everything's buzzing around.
Now, the 12 episodes in the winter, how long does it take to film those episodes? What I'm asking is, how long is the crew there?
You know, how it works is they will get a hold of me, and, you know, BBC, Nat Geo gets a hold of me and says, hey, what do you got going on? Oh, cool, do you mind if we film that? They always give me the option of yes or no, and then they come out maybe anywhere from a week to a couple of weeks at a time, and with, three or four people, and they just follow what I do. They have their own little dwelling that they live in. They have a safety person and a cook that cooks for them. So it's at maximum a group of four people, including their safety person, and they're self-contained. They don't want to impact what I do. They want to film what I do.
Oh, well, how does one in the summer, like if they're going to visit you, because you're 80 miles from the nearest road and 500 miles from the nearest person, how does one get to you?
Yeah, bush plane only. I have a mile and a half long airstrip next to the camp. It's an old Dewline Days airstrip made for the old Hercs and the C-130s and things like that. So it's one of the largest remote airstrips. And I don't lease the airstrip, but I maintain it with my ancient bobcat. But, you know, that's how people get out here. If you want to be here, you better fly in. It's mm-hmm. the only way you're going to get here.
Now, in the course of a year, how much time do you spend away from the camp?
In a normal year, if the show didn't exist and there was no PR to go do and I wasn't in the middle of breaking myself, I don't leave camp, but maybe once every couple of years.
Uh-huh. And all the supplies, are they flown in for you, or are you know, how much how do you get your supplies? Because you can't live totally off the land, I would imagine.
You know, no, you can't. There's no, like the other campers, they live around trees. A lot of them heat with wood. I'm several hundred miles north of the tree line. You know, you'd have to travel hours just to find a tree. I have to heat with oil, or I use jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a refueling station for planes that want. I'm the only gas station on the entire eastern side of the North Slope. So planes and helicopters, if they want fuel, they've got to come to me. In that respect, I can't, since there's no trees, I can't burn wood for my heat, so I have to use oil.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be flown in. When people come here, it's like a restaurant. I can't serve them game meat, so I have to fly in real food for them. But yeah, everything has to be flown in, whether it's toilet paper, a sheet of plywood, or fuel. It all has to be flown in to get here.
Okay, what is the water situation like that far north?
You know, sometime around the end of August or September, when I'm getting ready to freeze up, the only way, it's a protected ecosystem, I cannot drill a well for water, and even if I could, the ground's permanently frozen. So I have to get my water out of the river. But sometime late August or September, that's going to freeze over. So I roughly spend around 300 days without water, running water, so I have to put up water for the winter. And that's what I do. I have collection bins, and I put up between 200 and 300 gallons to last me through that time frame. There's, you know, for the camp, when it's summer, well, summer, spring, summer, and fall, from sometime around mid-June is when I get running water again. And, you know, I'll have people from June through the end of August, early September, but I have to drain all the water systems. You know, the pipes will freeze and bust otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And then on top of all that, there's also the light situation. Explain what happens with that.
I lose the sun sometime in October, and I get it back sometime between February and March. So I have several months where it's dark. But the turnaround is now I've got 24-hour daylight, and I don't expect another sunset until late August.
Now, you said you come down a little bit more often because you're doing publicity for the show Life Below Zero. I assume, like, now you're somewhere, are you in Anchorage, or are you in Los Angeles? Where are you right now?
In Cavick. I'm at camp.
Oh, you're at camp right now. So we're talking to you, like, via satellite phone, a camp of some sort?
Yeah, you're talking to me over the Internet.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it. I thought that for publicity purposes, they had moved you down into town. What I was going to ask, when you have to come in to do publicity for the show, does the civilized world, and I hate to call it the civilized world like you're not civilized, but does the modern world, does that drive you crazy? Are you fascinated by it, or can't wait to leave it?
You know, when I can plan ahead and I know that I'm going to be going, and I know when I'm going to be leaving. That's more important to me. You know, I get a set of dates. I get there on Monday. I leave on Friday. Then it's fun to go down and explore and interact and learn. And I'm like a little sponge, you know, and I soak up all the information. On the flip side, when I injured myself without any planning, it was 4 months of surgery. Then I got, you know, people, when they come out to where I live, it's called going bushy. They go a little nuts sometimes. It's the level of isolation, danger, everything, that it just is a lot for them to handle. Now, for me, the opposite's true. When I go to town, like for 4 months, I hadn't planned on being there, and people were hurting me, you know, having surgeries. That took a lot for me, and I get what's called town flu. And I can't wait to get the hell out.
Interesting.
And, you know, and I get all emo. And so, yeah, I'm much happier here.
Speaking of that injury, there was an episode that kind of dealt with, like, how you got injured. What was all seen on that episode?
What did it take to get from the site of the injury? You know, how it is, you know, where it happened. I wasn't in camp when it happened. And it took 2 days to get from where I was injured to Fairbanks, 3 days of sitting in a hotel room until a surgeon could be gotten. So it's the journey of from where I was injured, discovering what was wrong, how do we get me to safety, and the process of, finding out the extent of the injuries, and things are going to change.
We say that you're up there alone, but you're actually not up there alone, because there are animals, dangerous animals, that are also up there with you year-round.
For my apex predators, the wolves, the bears, I've already done a lot of their work for them. I've been injured in the past, so I walk with a little bit of a waddle and a limp, and I've culled myself from the herd. Those are the two main ingredients for a predator to say, lunchtime. So when everybody goes away and there's no crew, you know, it's like this winter, my main wolf pack has 21 in it, and they've never split up. But they came and attacked the camp. They ate a bunch of my foxes, which is what they do. But they also dogballed up on my satellite dish, so I didn't have any internet for a while until I could get parts flown in and dropped off out of the airplane.
What is the scariest thing that's happened to you while you're living up there in Alaska?
I think that most people would think I was attacked by a grizzly several years ago, and while it's not my favorite thing to talk about, it's a favorite thing for people to hear about. And just to give a quick once-over, I was getting water for myself. It was after the time of year when other people are here, and the fog suddenly came down to the ground, and while I was by the river, a bear snatched me up and rolled me around. I still have I had to sew my head and my arm back together and get the hips locked in place so I could go take care of him. But I laid here for 10 days. The hips were affected, the spine was compromised, and I couldn't move. So I laid here 10 days until somebody found me. And then, of course, got shipped down to the lower world for some spinal surgery. But and some people would think that that might be the scariest thing. Sometimes it's the weather itself. You know, last year the weather got so bad when I was flying out that I got dropped off about a mile from the end of my runway with 900 pounds of gear coming in. And I had to walk that all in. Well, I ran up against my personal wall, where I was exerting so much energy. I had the wolves about 300-400 yards away circling me, and it was, I don't know, it wasn't bad. It was like 50 below or so, but I couldn't exert any more energy to get that 900-pound load in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to realize I couldn't do it, and I don't run up into things where I can't very often. So I had to just simply admit, you're right, I can't do it 900 pounds at a time, but I can do it 10 pounds at a time. So I busted everything down into 10-pound loads, threw it in a garbage bag, and then I sat there, took me 8 hours, but I hucked it 10 pounds at a time all the way into camp.
Will you keep doing this show for a while, or is there an end date to this for you?
I have a film crew here right now. You'll see more. You know, it's like I've said before, if life is a horse race, bet on this old nag. I'm not done yet.
All right. I always enjoy when they give me the opportunity to talk to you. I'm so excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Continued success.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay. You take care. Bye-bye. All right. Admit to yourself, because we're on a podcast, so I can't hear you, but admit to yourself, when you were listening to Sue, you were saying one of two things, like, wow, I'd love to do that, for at least for a little bit, live just totally by myself in Alaska, or no way, I could never do that, never would I want to do that, live in the dark for 6, 7, 8 months all by myself up north with wolves and bears surrounding me and frozen water and just wondering if I was going to run out of supplies. I'm in the camp of the first part in the second part where, no, I wouldn't want to do that. I'd like to visit up there. I'd visit up there during the light time. Definitely would visit during the summer. I'd love to see the Northern Lights sometime, and I understand it's great up there. But, man, that is a difficult, difficult life, and it takes a special person that wants to do that, and obviously Sue is that person. All right, we're going to shift gears here and skip across the pond, as they say, and go to Scotland to a man from an organization called Wilderness Scotland. We have Stevie Christie on the line here. And Stevie, you know, when you think about Scotland, I'm going to be honest, I think like most people, I don't really think of wilderness.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I guess the traditional view of Scotland is probably one of castles and golf courses, but if you look into the background of those images in your head, you'll find mountains and coastlines and wild places ready to be explored by hiking or biking or however you want to go.
Yes, and that's what your company offers, is a chance to visit the wilderness of Scotland in different methods. And also, and I don't know why I didn't think about this, but there's also island hopping, and Scotland is known for some beautiful islands.
That's right, yeah. We're a very small country, but we've actually got over 700 islands around the coastline of Scotland. Now, only about 10% of those are inhabited, but whether there's people living there or not, they're amazing places to explore. both from a cultural point of view, from a wildlife point of view, and of course the great scenery out there.
Yeah, tell us about some of the islands that that you offer as excursions.
Sure. Well, I guess that the most famous of all is the Isle of Skye, and we run a lot of hiking trips there and some cycling trips as well. It's one very much steeped with myth and legend and history, from Bonnie Prince Charlie and Flora MacDonald to the misty mountains of the Coolin Hills, and it's a great place to visit. But much as you have the Grand Canyon and Yosemite over in the States, there's lots of other amazing little places that are less well known, but just as interesting to go and discover. And in fact, just last week I was on a trip with some clients, and we had a Zodiac that we were using that day, and we went over and visited two little uninhabited islands on the north coast that I'd never been to before. But they were fascinating places. The people had lived there and farmed there until the 1930s. So there was just a lovely human history and peacefulness about these little islands that only took us 20 minutes to hike from one side to the other side of the island, but it felt like a whole world away.
When you visit those islands, first of all, can you give the name of the island so people listening can maybe go to Google Earth and find them on the map?
Yeah, sure. The Isle of Skye is quite easy. It's just spelled S-K-Y-E, and it's on the west coast. The wee island I was on last week is called Ilan Nan Ron, which is a Gaelic name, and it translates to the Island of the Seals. And it's just located on the north coast of Scotland, just opposite a little village called Tongue, which is just spelled like the tongue in your mouth. It's not one that will appear in any tourist books, or there's really not that much about it online, even if they Googled it. But what a beautiful little place to visit. Like I say, it was my first time there. There were sea stacks, natural arches, and just a lovely feel about the place.
Well, when you said that they used to farm there till the 30s, did you find remnants of like communities or farms that were there?
That's right, yeah. There was actually, there's probably about 20 or 30 houses which had stood untouched since the 1930s. And they're actually in pretty good condition, given that's 80 years ago now. They've just been standing there, taking the full force of the fairly wild weather you can get there, especially over the winter time. So it was quite, in a way, sort of ghostly walking around this empty sort of township, but at the same time, it was quite charming. And in fact, today, because the island's just 2 miles offshore, and the grazing for sheep on the island is actually very good. It's very grassy soil there. So there's actually still farmers use the island for grazing, and they put the sheep over there for the summertime and then bring them back to the mainland in the winter.
Oh, that's interesting. So they hire a boat, take their livestock over there, and then the safety of the island, they're pretty much, there's no predators, they don't have to worry about fencing, and they just bring them back at the end of the season?
Yeah, exactly that. So it was a lovely sort of transition from the older history of the place, when people would have lived on the island as well and farmed much smaller areas, to its transition today is effectively like a little island ranch, if you like, that just with nothing on the island that can cause the sheep any harm. They just have the freedom of the island for the whole summer.
Now, are there any islands that offer like sandy beaches? I assume it's probably too cold to go swimming, but still, are there any islands out there that do offer beaches?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that people find most surprising when they come over. And in fact, the clients I was with last week were from California, and we took them to some beaches, and the beaches can be like a mile long, white sand like you wouldn't believe, and the water is sparkling and turquoise like you would see in the Caribbean. Now, there is the slight difference in temperature, of course, but it really, the beaches all really surprise people, because it's just not an association they have with it. And it's funny, because you guys are obviously used to swimming in a lot warmer water than Scottish people are. I would always go and swim in the sea when I was a kid, with no wetsuit or anything. But you'll be amazed at how many people, when you pitch up on a highland beach and there's no one around apart from yourselves, and they've had maybe at the end of a hike, and you think, maybe I will go in for a wee swim, even if it's colder, or maybe just up to my knees, is it?
Uh-huh. And then they find out it's very, very cold.
Yeah, that's when they remember they're not in the Caribbean and they are, in fact, in the Highlands.
So do you still swim without a wetsuit, or is it, as you've gotten older, it's like you can't bear it anymore?
Probably, yeah, a little bit towards the latter. But occasionally, if I find myself on a beach, like today, I live in the Highlands, and today's glorious. It's 26 degrees, which I guess is maybe low 80s Fahrenheit. And yeah, some of my colleagues have been out swimming in some of the lochs just outside our office today. And a day like today could probably tempt me in. And certainly my young daughter, who's 5, she'll go into the sea any opportunity with no thought of a wetsuit or anything.
Yes, and there's probably not very many opportunities where the weather's that warm, I would imagine.
Well, it's probably, Scotland's a kind of place with a really poor reputation for weather, and in that sense it usually almost over-delivers because it's not nearly as bad as people would have you make out. And yeah, a day like today is very beautiful, but yeah, we do get sunshine most of the summer, so it's a pretty good place to live.
All right. Well, I will accept the gentle correction. Thank you very much. Now, there's also a similar company called Wilderness Ireland, and I don't know if you get to do any guiding in Ireland, but I know that the Blanket Islands is one of the places that they go to, and not only is that on the UNESCO World Heritage map, but also is that where they're filming Star Wars?
Right, yeah, so that's down in off the Dingle Peninsula in Ireland, yeah. A really beautiful part of the Emerald Isle, for sure. Star Wars, I'm not sure if they filmed on those islands in particular, but certainly just a little bit further out, out on the more open ocean, there's a little island group called Skellig Michael. And it really, I say island group, it's almost just like some large rocks protruding from the sea. But when you go there, for me, the first time I got there, I was just amazed that this wasn't one of the most famous sites in the world. To me, it felt like a bit like somebody had taken like Machu Picchu from Peru, mm-hmm. and just planted it in the middle of the ocean. And it was just it's an astonishing place with these intricate little stairways carved up into the rock, and some monks used to live there. And certainly they used that as a Star Wars location. And I think that's where one of the leading actors actually took a little tumble and maybe broke a bone, unfortunately. But it's an amazing place to visit, and I mean, it should be on everybody's tick list. They're quite phenomenal.
Wait, you personally took the tumble on the steps and broke a bone?
Oh, not me. No, I think it was one of the Star Wars actors.
Oh, okay, okay.
Did that.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay. Well, so this island here, as you said, there were monks that lived there at one time, and they built the steps. And what else is left? You said it was almost like Machu Picchu. What else is left from their monastery?
Yeah, it's like they have these little shelters called beehive shelters, which a little stone... It almost looks like a little egg or a beehive, I guess, would be the obvious shape. And they're not very large at all. They're really just big enough to go inside and sit down, and that's all the space you have. But the monks, they would practice solitude, and they would go in there to have completely cut off from everything, so they could devote their entire thought to their religion. So you still will see some of those beehive shelters, not just on that island, but actually all up the west coast of Ireland. You can find those little beehive shelters, and yeah, they're fascinating to go and see as well.
Now, also though, there's also a chance to see some incredible marine life when you go on some of these islands, and I understand there's even a chance to spot whales.
Yeah, again, we have great marine life all up the west coast of Scotland, in particular in the north coast, and then of course out on the west coast of Ireland. Certainly, when you're on the coastline, it's not too difficult if you're in the right place to see things like porpoises and dolphins in close. And if you want to come out and sea kayak, then for sure you're going to see some other things. Occasionally, we've got a couple of pods of orcas that you get around the coast. And whales, if you're out in a sailboat, then you've got a pretty reasonable chance of seeing whales, mostly minke whales, but some other whales as well. And one other sort of sea creature, which is not so well known, but we actually have the world's second largest fish, lives in the coastline of Scotland and Ireland. It's called a basking shark, and it's a plankton-eating shark. But they grow like 6 meters long, and they're big and very shark-like. And you can actually, one or two places, go out with some scientists and shark experts and get in the water with them, in a wetsuit, of course, and snorkel alongside them, which is a pretty mind-blowing experience.
Wow, it sounds like there's a lot of adventures that I didn't even consider. Once again, you can go to the websites Wilderness Ireland or Wilderness Scotland, find out about some of the adventures. As you said, a lot of people just think it's castles and golf, and there's a lot more to Scotland and Ireland that meets the eye.
Absolutely, yeah. It'd be great to have some more of you folks over here.
All right. Well, you know what? I've added it to my bucket list now of next visit to Great Britain to make sure not only did I go to Scotland but see some of the wilderness, because that's the kind of adventure I'd like. And so I don't play golf, but I would love to see some of these islands. And Stevie, really appreciate your time this morning and the long distance phone call that you paid for. I want to tell everybody know that you paid for the phone call, and I appreciate it greatly.
Not at all. Great to speak to you as well, Mark.
All right, Steve. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. All the best. Bye-bye.
How could you not love Stevie's accent? That was awesome. And you know what? That goes into our Travel with Hawkeye Accent Hall of Fame, along with Caroline Makepeace from Australia. We had her on a couple episodes before. So those two are my top two favorite episodes. If you didn't get a chance to listen to Caroline, she's on episode 18. All right, that wraps it up for this episode of Travel with Hawkeye. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. Don't forget, you can always follow us on our Instagram stories at Hawkeye On Air. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, also on at Hawkeye On Air. If you just found us, you can find us also on iTunes. Make sure you subscribe there. And also at travelwithhawkeye.net. That is our website. And check out my new book, San Antonio Uncovered. I hope that you will enjoy it. If you're a fan of San Antonio or Texas, it kind of goes into the unusual, and we'll talk about that in a future episode also. My name is Mark Hawkeye Lewis. For everybody that's been a part of this Travel with Hawkeye episode, we thank you. And remember, the world is out there. Your adventure awaits.